Hello, this is Jay Sperling Reich. I wanted to take a moment to let you know that moments before we recorded this week's episode, Michael Giltz, one of our hosts, was sent off on assignment. Rather than exclude him from this week's episode, he joins us by mobile phone, which can make him a little difficult to understand at times. But if you bear with us, I promise it's worth it, especially the interview with author Edward J. Epstein on Hollywood accounting practices. It starts somewhere around the 45-minute mark. As always, thanks for listening. For the week of July 11th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 62, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And don't tell Oprah, but driving in my car and talking on my cell phone at the same time, I'm Michael Giltz.
No, she just doesn't want you to text.
Pretty sure she doesn't want you to talk either. And if you do, use hands-free, and I'm not doing that either.
What? Are you serious? Okay, I hate people like you.
I know. I don't want to. I hate it, but I'm doing it for the podcast. I'm risking my life for my, our viewers, our listeners.
Yeah, yours and everybody around you. That's beautiful.
Exactly. That's why I don't do it normally.
And that's because you have net points in the profitability of this podcast. And if you don't know what that means, you will by the end of this episode, because later we will have Edward J. Epstein on, and he will be explaining to us how a movie like Harry Potter can make $938 million at the box office and still be in the red. We'll also be talking about Lionsgate and Icon, Carl Icon, that is, the activist investor. Looks like they're coming to a truce. Finally, Miramax looks like it has been sold. The Emmy nominations were announced last week, and we'll go over all of the big nominees and a few omissions. The sales of concert tickets have plummeted, and we'll touch on just how far they've gone down. With VidCon happening last week, YouTube has been in the news a lot, and they've announced a new partner grant program, a new way to fund some of their content, and some high-def initiatives. We'll tell you about them. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, our lightning round, we're going to be talking a lot about people going to jail and those getting out. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire on the road, calling in from his cell phone, Michael Giltz. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And I'm doing it without a net to keep up the net. I'm doing this from my memory.
No, we are not going to do
number
this
one movie.
The entire podcast, are we?
No, no,
an
no.
Excuse to use the word net? We're net going to do that, are we? Sorry, go on.
The number one movie at the box office is Despicable Me, starring Steve Carell. Is he a movie star now? The movie grossed $60 million. It was far exceeding the box office predictions of all the tracking companies, so they again are in trouble for being way off base. Number two was Twilight Eclipse, which grossed $33 million. It's at $237 million total in the U.S., which is exactly where we told you it would be when the movie opened. It's tracking right along with Twilight New Moon. Number three is Predators, the most successful Predator sequel yet, even though there's just been two. It grossed $25 million. At $23 million, it's probably the biggest news of the week. It's Toy Story 3, grossing $23 million. It's number four for the week, but it's chugging along, it's doing great, and it is now the top-grossing movie of the year, just passing Alice in Wonderland. It's now at $340 million. It's also the number one grossing Pixar movie of all time in North America, just passing Finding Nemo, though it's going to take a lot of money overseas for it to pass Finding Nemo worldwide. Next up is The Last Airbender, which grossed $17 million. That is now at $100 million in the U.S., but it is falling fast. It fell over 60% from last weekend. It is really taking a tumble. And then at number six is the Adam Sandler Chris Rock movie Grown Ups, which grossed another $16 million and is at $111 million in the U.S. That's chugging along. And you've got some holdovers like A-Team and movies like that. And at the bottom is probably the indie success story of the week, Cyrus, which is, again is in the top 10. It grossed $1.7 million, so it's at $3.5 million total. That and Winter's Bone are the genuine indie success stories of the week. I saw Despicable Me. I was bored by it. What did you guys do? Did you see any movies this weekend?
I did see Despicable Me this weekend in a packed theater. I saw it in 3D, of course. It turns out that movie's gross was not overly affected by 3D. Approximately 45% of the movie's earnings came from the 1,551 premium-priced 3D screens that it showed on, and that's really low.
We're watching 3D fall on its face week after week. The amount of people are actively walking away from movies and trying not to see them in 3D. I was forced to see it in 3D because I only had a limited time. I had to see it at this point in the day, and it was the only one showing. If I'd had a choice, I would have seen it in 2D. And people are more, every week, they're choosing more and more to not see movies in 3D because they don't want to pay the extra money. We're literally, over the last 3 months, you can see the percentage of money grossed from 3D screens dropping week by week by week. People are sick of it. And this is a big week for 3D. Three of the top five films were in 3D. The World Cup was shown in movie theaters around the country in 3D. Next week, the All-Star Game is in 3D. And, you know, if you can access it on certain cable channels. So 3D is spreading, but people are not happy about it.
But, Michael, you really think that they walk away from the theater because their only choice is to see it in 3D?
They're saying, I want to see it in 2D when they can. And they're actively seeking out the 2D time frames. And when they can't, they're either not going at all and seeing something else, or they're going to see in 3D. But, you know, these families aren't always forced to say, oh, my God, we have to see something at, you know, 2 p.m. on Saturday. They have flexibility. And when they have the option,
I actually would disagree with that. I would say they would have less flexibility than you do.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I can
tell
you.
But that's the only reason they're paying to see it in 3D at all. I'm saying if every theater you went to, you could go at 2 o'clock and see it in 2D or 3D. I'm saying more and more people in the box office shows that they're saying, I want to see it in 2D. They're saying, I don't want to pay the extra $50.
I think you're completely right. And I think we have this argument every single week. But I do think that it's interesting that, because I think your point is actually right. I think people are starting to realize that 3D is not all it's cracked up to be. And 3D is not necessarily adding to ticket sales, maybe to box office, but...
You know, Michael, you mentioned that that the World Cup was broadcast in 3D in movie theaters. I actually attended one of those screenings here in Los Angeles. You know, I have to say, and I'm not going to get too technical, but because of the way it's broadcast, it's beamed up in 1080i and then put together back in 1080p. The close-up shots looked amazing, were crystal clear. The shots that we're used to seeing, kind of those midfield shots where you can see all the players on the field, the ball was kind of a little fuzzy and hard to see at times. But I'm being
that's exactly what you want when you're watching soccer.
Well, no, mind you, I'm being very picky. I'm being a tech head here, but everybody loved
it. It's not ready for prime time yet.
No, actually, it's fine. It really did. You know, it was a blast sitting in it with an audience that was cheering, and somebody had a vuvuzela.
Well, it's fun to see it with an audience, just like going to a sports bar. That's why I saw most of the World Cup, but the 3D, it sounds like, was not quite technically up to snuff yet as far as you were concerned.
Just on a very, very technical level, and I'm sure, I mean, this is the first time they've done this, I am sure that it will get much, much better. And it's, let's put it this way, it was pretty good, and it gave you a sense for what it's like to be on the field. There were shots where you were actually behind the players, and you could sense how far the players were from one another and just how far they had to kick the ball to get to the next player. And that was really, really cool.
But you can't drink beer, right?
Actually, you could.
But out of your flask?
No. This was at the bridge over. So it's a kind of an upscale theater.
Yeah.
They have a liquor license, but it was a lot of fun. And I think, you know, for a first off, not bad at all.
Cool.
But we should probably move on to some movie news. And finally, we can talk about, well, let's start off with Miramax, and we can finally talk about how looks like they're sold. Ronald Tudor and Colony Capital will be paying somewhere in the neighborhood of $650 to $675 million to buy the library.
So what happened with Bob and Harvey Weinstein's attempt to get it back?
They lost out.
It just underbid.
They could not come to an agreement on terms. And so they lost out on their exclusive negotiating period, and then Disney entered an exclusive negotiating period with Ronald Tudor. And it looks like they are 95% done on coming to terms. So,
did you guys read earlier in the week that Rob Lowe wanted to toss his hat in the ring?
You know what? That was completely bogus, and the only reason that was a headline is because he is an investor in Colony Capital, so that's
has
nothing to do with reality, frankly. It's not like he's going to be, you know, become a movie mogul.
Damn.
And Ann Thompson is saying, you know, it's not that anybody's really going to become a movie mogul with this sale. She says, quote, "I don't buy the idea of anyone starting up Miramax as a production entity. This is a library asset sale, assuming it goes through." So really, it's all about distribution, not only of the films that have been made by Miramax previously, but any that Miramax might pick up in the future. She doesn't believe that it's actually going to turn around and start making movies like The Gangs of New York.
Yeah, why would they? I mean, they're not set up for that at all.
Well, that would be a good thing, Sperling.
Yeah, no, I'm just letting people know.
And then what's the deal with Carl Icahn? Basically, they're sort of trying to come to terms a little bit. Carl Icahn on the board that's in charge of Lionsgate.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing what happens when your company gets a new majority stakeholder who has said he wants to fire you. All of a sudden, Lionsgate management is saying, you know what, maybe we should, you know, we should probably have a truce with Carl Icahn, this activist investor who has now gotten 38% of our stock. Maybe we should, you know, settle down and explain to him what it is we want to do by merging with MGM or merging with Summit, the company that releases the Twilight franchise. And so that's what they're doing. They're sitting down and kind of going over all of these strategic alliances and mergers that they had planned. And Lionsgate management is trying to find some even ground with Carl Icahn. Now, what's interesting to me, at least, is at the end of this 10 days, if a deal is not reached between Icahn and Lionsgate management, and if the truce is not then renewed, so if they don't renew it for another 10 days, then Lionsgate has to reveal publicly all of the information they shared with Icahn. So that way, he can pursue any other tender he might want or a proxy fight. He can't have non-public information.
Huh, okay.
I don't know. Maybe that's just interesting
to me.
That's
a little technical.
Yeah, apparently that's interesting only to me.
You.
Yeah. What about the fact that, you know, here Carl Icahn is saying, oh, you know, the management doesn't know what they're doing. Meanwhile, they get 26 Emmy nominations.
Yeah, we get to talk about the Emmys. That's more like it.
You know, I haven't had a chance to review. I know they happened in the middle of last week. Do we want to review some of them?
Absolutely. The biggest news is Glee, right? 19 nominations.
Yep.
Yeah, there were lots of new shows and new talent nominated this year. Outstanding Drama, Lost, Breaking Bad, Dexter, Mad Men, True Blood, and The Good Wife were nominated. And that's not just one show. Those were all different shows.
You know, people are wondering why 24 wasn't nominated. They kind of, even though 24 didn't have a good last season, they're saying that they should have...
Well, 24, Law and Order, and there's another, and Ugly Betty were all having their final goodbyes. They weren't nominated. Lost was.
Friday Night Lights wasn't nominated. Wanted to weep.
Yeah, Friday Night Lights was one that a lot of people felt should have been nominated.
Absolutely, but it finally got nominations for Best Actor and Actress. I mean, you know, they've been dragging their feet on this show for 4 years, four seasons. You know, finally, I mean, the whole cast is great. And finally, the two leads, Connie Britton and Kyle Chandler, got nominated for playing the husband and wife, the coach and his wife, who's now the school principal. And the show has really been good creatively this year. It's really, you know, had a great first season, a horrible second season, and a really good third and fourth season. So I was happy to see that. But when you look at the drama nominations, the big thing that jumps out to me is that the major networks are almost getting out of the drama business as far as good dramas. You know, they're out of the TV movie business and the miniseries business, and 5 years from now, they may stop making decent dramas because four out of the six are from cable. They're, you know, AMC with Mad Men and Breaking Bad, Showtime with Dexter, HBO with True Blood. You've only got The Good Wife with Julianna Margulies and Lost, which is in its final year, coming from a major network.
Well, and this seems like it would be a good time to go over the network tally. HBO had a whopping 101 nominations for its shows.
Doesn't surprise me.
It's not too surprising. ABC had 63, CBS had 57, NBC came in with 48, barely edging out Fox with 47. Now AMC.
Oh, that doesn't bode well.
Well, the fact that they got any is.
Amazing.
Yeah. AMC had 26. Of course, that's the network that Mad Men airs on here in North America.
And Breaking Bad. The best show on television.
Showtime had 23. And then I'll just stop there because I could go on, but, you know, I have...
No.
Yeah, there's reason to.
Well, HBO's nominations came from The Pacific, which was their miniseries about World War II in the Pacific, and a lot of their TV movies. True Blood did get a Best Drama nomination, but that was practically it. It got shut out in the acting categories and got nothing else. So there's not actually a lot of love for True Blood, which is certainly one of the hotter shows on TV right now.
Well, and Outstanding Actress in a Drama, you mentioned that Connie Britton from Friday Night Lights was nominated, but so were Juliana Margulies, Mariska Hargitay from Special Victims Unit, and Juliana Margulies is from The Good Wife, Glenn Close from Damages, Kira Sedgwick from The Closer, and January Jones from Mad Men.
That really surprised me.
Oh, it didn't surprise me that much.
Why?
I think she's just fine in Mad Men. I think she's good. But she was so awful when she guest starred on Saturday Night Live that you really realize what a bad actress she is.
well, she's being nominated for Mad Men.
Do you watch The Good Wife? How are you enjoying that? Are you happy?
Oh, I love that show. I absolutely love that show. And I think that Juliana Margulies is really, really great in it. But I would love to see Connie Britton win this, especially because Juliana Margulies won last year.
Yeah, that would be awesome. It's not going to happen, I don't think. It would be a miracle.
It's never going to happen.
It would be a Hail Mary pass.
Yeah.
Now, outstanding actor in a drama, John Hamm for Mad Men, Kyle Chandler for Friday Night Lights, as you mentioned previously, Bryan Cranston, Breaking Bad, Hugh Laurie, House MD, Michael C. Hall for Dexter, and Matthew Fox for Lost. Now, in the comedy world, or category, I should say, you mentioned Glee. Well, it was nominated for Best Comedy Series, along with Modern Family, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Nurse Jackie, 30 Rock, and The Office.
None of those surprised me. I know people were surprised that, you know, like Cougar Town wasn't on this list, and Mike, I think somebody said that The Middle should have been on this list. I don't think so. I don't think either one of those shows is quite ready for it yet.
Now, are they changing the name of Cougar Town? I heard a rumor that they were changing.
No, I think that they all kind of wish they'd never named it that, but I don't think that they're going to go back and change the name. You know, I have to say, on this list, I know I'm really, really in the minority here, but I think Modern Family is one of the most overrated shows out there. I think it's funny, but I think Cougar Town and The Middle are so much funnier.
You can send your emails directly to Karen at... Yeah, you're just... That's like email bait if I've ever seen it.
You know, I'm with Karen on that, but I'm gonna watch Modern Family on DVD and see, give it another shot and say, all right, let me check out the whole season. You know, because I felt a little indifferent to it as well. But if you look at the list overall, you see that the networks, while they're not making any quality dramas, they are still in the comedy business. Most of these are major networks. They still do much better than cable and all the other stuff. I think the biggest missing show, which I don't even like, is The Big Bang Theory, which is probably the hottest sitcom on TV. It's just below 2.5 million in the ratings. Everybody loves it. It's very popular. I think casual fans would wonder why the heck that's not on there. And it does get good critical attention as well. So that's probably the biggest diss. But, you know, Entourage, The Office, and 30 Rock, those are just tired old things. And if they're going to nominate comedies, they should have nominated Archer as an animated comedy. You know, they had Family Guy on there last year. Why not have Archer on?
I think Family Guy was left out entirely this year, wasn't it?
In the animated category, the only thing I know is that Archer, which is one of my favorite new shows of the year, was nominated for Best Voice Work, but did not make it into the Best Animated Series category.
Now, outstanding actress in a comedy, Lea Michele for Glee, Tina Fey for 30 Rock, Toni Collette for The United States of Tara, Julia Louis-Dreyfus for The New Adventures of Old Christine, Edie Falco for Nurse Jackie, and Amy Poehler for Parks and Recreation. Now, did you hear what Tina Fey said when she learned she was nominated?
Hello.
Yeah.
She said, "This is great and exciting news. Also, this seems like an appropriate time for me to announce to NBC that I will not be renewing my contract with my gym."
At my gym. You know, I find all of these women tired. They're nominated over and over and over again. Well, with the exception maybe of Amy Poehler.
Well, and
Edie Falco, I think, is funny.
What about Lea Michele?
No, I think she's okay.
All right, well.
I think the show is great. I think she is only okay. But there are people, there are comedy actresses that I think are a lot better than these women. Or let me rephrase, these women. I mean, I think Tina Fey is really funny, but she wins every year. I mean, she shouldn't even be submitted anymore. There ought to be, you know, some kind of a clause that if you've won twice, you're out.
Well, for lead actor in a comedy, Ed O'Neill from Modern Family decided not to submit his name. Instead, he put his name in the ensemble supporting actor category.
Good.
And he didn't get any nomination, but everybody else in the show Modern Family did. Here's outstanding actor in a comedy, Larry David for Curb Your Enthusiasm, Alec Baldwin for 30 Rock, Matthew
Again, the clause would get rid of him. He wins every year.
Matthew Morrison for Glee, Steve Carell for The Office, Jim Parsons for The Big Bang Theory, and Tony Shalhoub for Monk. I didn't even know that show was still on the air.
I think it was his final season. I don't find any of these men funny. I mean, I think Larry David is funny. And I think, obviously, Alec Baldwin is. But I don't think the rest of them are funny at all. Jim Parsons. Okay, I'll toss that to him. But nobody here excites me.
Well, here are a couple of omissions. House didn't make the cut among the drama series this year, and it hasn't in the past. Courtney Cox didn't get nominated for Cougar Town.
She's not that funny in it. Krista Miller is a hell of a lot funnier.
Charlie Sheen will have to console himself with a salary raise, but not an Emmy nomination. He was nominated 4 years in a row, but not this year. Speaking of which, David Letterman had a streak broken, a 26-year-long streak since 1984, the first full season of Late Night on NBC. Letterman had gotten a Best Variety or Musical Comedy Series nomination and Best Writing for a VMC Series nomination every single year, and that includes when he moved over to The Late Show on CBS. And this year he did not get nominated for either, or his show didn't get nominated. So that's a 26-year streak that's broken.
Yeah, that's interesting. Why do you think that was?
I think everybody was making room for Conan O'Brien, who did get nominated for The Tonight Show. He actually tweeted, congrats to my staff on 4 Emmy nominations. This bodes well for the future of The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien.
Well, you know, that's obviously a diss at Jay Leno. He got shut out in primetime and in late night, but that's been happening for years. The Tonight Show often doesn't get nominated for Best Variety Show. Jay Leno often does not get nominated for Best Host. And he's got a thick skin at this point. And I think that's the thing that drives him to prove himself against what he sees as sort of the resistance of the community. You know, he's not loved. And that's what's going to drive him to make The Tonight Show get back on top of the ratings even more than it already is.
Well, before we talk about those ratings, you're right, Jay Leno did not get a nomination for either primetime or his return to The Tonight Show. And referencing the Super Bowl ad he appeared in with David Letterman and Oprah Winfrey, he said on his show, quote, "And David Letterman didn't get nominated either. Oh, man, I guess David and I will be watching the Emmys at Oprah's house this year." Yuck, 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 yuck. That's my poor Jay Leno impersonation. But, you know, he might not have to worry about that because ABC News Nightline, actually, for the week of June 28th, 2010, was the number one show among total viewers during that hour. It beat out both The Late Show with David Letterman, which it's beat out for the past 12 weeks, and it beat out the Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Is it a half-hour show?
Yes, yes, that is true. So it's beating it in that half hour. It's pulling in 3.8 million total viewers, and it's just 20,000 viewers away from first place for the entire year.
Wow.
Well, that's because Conan was so low.
Yeah,
just
maybe.
Just Jay Leno has to make up for the low ratings that Conan had. You know, because Conan was in third place.
Well, now, Michael, you mentioned Saturday Night Live earlier, or maybe it was Karen. You mentioned it with January Jones hosting it. But Betty White hosted it on May 8th, and that episode got a lot of nominations. In fact, the show garnered 13 Emmy Award nominations, making it the most nominated show in the award programs in the history of the Emmys.
Wow, good for them.
Meaning the total number of nominations gotten over the years.
Yes, in fact, they surpassed ER, which had 124 nominations.
That's really a big deal.
Yes, but we're not on Big Deal or Big
Whoop
yet.
Well, you're on the air for decades. Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, you see, you got to be fast around here. You know, if you weren't driving, Michael, you know.
You totally would have caught that.
You would have been right on that. But let's move on to music and talk about some concert tickets, which apparently people aren't talking about these days because concert ticket sales are down 15% in the first half of 2010. At least that's
what... They're too expensive.
They are too expensive.
And yeah, exactly. They're way too expensive.
Yeah, I mean, Polestar discovered an approximate 15% drop among key concert industry indicators, and it's not exactly a complete across-the-board drop in ticket sales, but larger shows are feeling the economic pain more than smaller counterparts. So more club shows are still attracting respectable-sized audiences.
Because they don't charge anywhere near as much.
I would agree with that.
And that's why festivals are doing okay, because you get to see 10 or 15 acts in a week, and you feel like you're getting your money's worth.
Right. I mean, that's an event. You go, you spend 3 days there, you get your shoes all dirty, you get all sweaty, and you drop $300 for tickets. But, you know, when you're dropping $300 for tickets for 2.5 hours of a concert to see
sweaty?
The Rolling Stones. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, because they're usually... in the desert or something.
And one example of this is, of course, the American Idol Tour, which has dropped a number of cities and has switched some venues, I believe. It's the entire tour is contracted. And again, this is not a reflection, I don't think, as some people have said, of the people who are on Idol this year. I think it really is just a reflection of the industry as a whole.
Oh, yeah. When I went to the American Idol concert, the one with Adam Lambert, it was half empty.
Oh, really? Wow. Well,
oh, yeah.
You know, yeah, they dropped a number of dates. Much like Lilith Fair, we announced that last week. They dropped, I think, 7 dates. They dropped 7 dates for the American Idol tour. Off the slate are Omaha, Nebraska, Kansas City, Missouri, Toronto, Buffalo, New York, Winnipeg, Manitoba, and Cleveland. So Cleveland loses not only LeBron James, but also the American Idol concert.
It's okay. It's still hot in Cleveland.
It's still hot in Cleveland, which was picked up by, what is it, Comedy Central?
TV Land.
Okay, well, the top 100 tours for the first 6 months have a combined gross of $965.5 million, which is down $196.8 million, or 17% from the same period 1 year ago. And if you want to find a lower number, you'll have to go all the way back to 2005, when the mid-year gross volume was about $730.9 million. Now, who do you think is on the top of the concert charts? Who would you say, Michael?
Bon Jovi.
No, you read the show notes.
No, I didn't. I was going to guess.
You're such a liar. Okay, quick, who's second?
I'm trying to think of the tour. It's not Sound Like Garfunkel, it's Edmund Gillespie, James Taylor, and Carole King.
Okay, you totally read the show notes,
yes.
You cheater.
No, I'm on the...
Okay.
My friend went to the Bon Jovi Kid Rock tour, and I was almost going to go to James Taylor and Carole King, so that's why those were on my mind. I know they're touring. U2 didn't tour, Sound Like Garfunkel didn't tour. I can't help it if I'm on top of the news.
What about third place? Who came in third?
I have no idea.
Taylor Swift. She sold $34.2 million worth of tickets at 39 shows in 30 cities. Bon Jovi, 38 shows in 28 markets, sold $52.8 million worth of concert tickets. And as you said, James Taylor, Carole King came in second. They played 33 shows in 27 markets, selling over 473,000 tickets for a total gross of $41 million, which should tell you those tickets must be ungodly expensive.
Yeah, they are. That's why I didn't go. I'm actually surprised that the concerts haven't fallen more. You know, they're just comparing to last year, of course, but with all the big acts that didn't go out, if just U2 hadn't had a bad back and Art Garfunkel's voice hadn't gone out, that would make up that 15% right there.
Well, now...
we wouldn't be talking about any dip in total grosses.
Well, in fourth place, you got Paul McCartney, another veteran. He earned $31.6 million at 7 shows. And Michael, you'll just be happy to know that in sixth place, your favorite band of all time, the Black Eyed Peas.
Oh, awesome. Black Eyed Peas, they're not in sixth, that's just the tail end of their tour, so that's why they're only in sixth place, because they've been a big, big concert draw, God knows why, but...
Well, let's move on to digital media, where the VidCon conference was held here in Los Angeles last week, and YouTube announced that they will be moving from Flash to HTML5, at least for their mobile platform. Of course, they're doing that because both the iPhone and iPad do not support Flash.
Apple wins again.
And I bet if you did a poll of the guys who went to the VidCon conference that they all would have said the Big Bang Theory is the best sitcom on television. Because it's filled with nerds.
We're so done with television news that I don't even know where he's
Dude,
coming.
Michael, you really got to catch up.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's this whole driving, trying to host
okay.
a podcast.
This is a huge deal, though, for people who don't really understand what HTML5 is. And God knows I can't explain it. But the fact that the iPad... And the iPhone don't use Flash was just, you know, it was a minor nuisance for people who use those devices. And now that YouTube is finally kind of catering to Apple, or I don't know how to put it, but this is a big deal.
Yes, it is a big deal.
And I'm not trying to make a segue here.
Again,
this is a big deal.
We're not on Big Deal or Big Whoop yet.
I know. I just get so excited.
Well, HTML5 is a video codec and for streaming video online. And the reason that YouTube wants to do this is they are now streaming 100 million mobile video plays per day. They really need to make sure that those popular platforms like Android, like the iPhone, and like iPad are capable of streaming YouTube videos on the go.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much common knowledge in the geek world that HTML5 was what was eventually everyone was going to turn to. So it's just interesting that YouTube's first.
Yes. Speaking of YouTube and content, two announcements. One is that they are going to be doing a partner grant program. Now, they've always had content partners, except what they've noticed is that they get a lot of music videos, but most of that professional content goes straight to Hulu or other sites, not YouTube. Instead, what they get is a lot of cats riding around on vacuum cleaners or playing piano. So during a keynote at last week's VidCon, YouTube announced the creation of a new $5 million partners grant that is meant to help stoke the creation of some of this original content on YouTube by funding promising video ventures.
Like who? Who their partner is going to be?
Well, it depends on who they pick.
Like a guy in his bedroom who gets a lot of hits, or will it be a production company?
It could be either.
When 5 million is peanuts, I'll be more interested when they start to name who they're giving money to.
Well, and they
It'd be interesting if some of the people who are viral hits that are not professionals actually get money from them.
And I think that's where they're headed. They are going to identify those partners based on growth rate, audience engagement, and production expertise. They're going to select those partners and have them write a proposal. The proposals will be evaluated, and based on what was written in the distribution plan and the marketing plan, they will actually give those partners money to make more professional videos.
Hmm.
And will they be taking a piece of that? And when they do that, will they say, all right, now you won't get back any money from your ads or hits until X number, you know, are they investing in them, or are they just saying, here's a grant, take the money and have fun? Are they the NEA, or are they trying to invest in these people?
No, actually, it's funny you should mention that. They say here that on their blog that this fund is quote, to act as a catalyst by infusing additional funds into their production budgets of a small group of YouTube partners who are at the forefront of innovation. It goes on to say the funds are, quote, an advance against the partner's future revenue share. So some of these partners make a lot of money, like that whole Susan Boyle thing where she, you know, was on Britain's Got Talent and it got 75 million views. Well, the ads on that actually earned quite a bit of money. So, and that was shared.
Not for Susan Boyle, though.
Not for Susan Boyle, but for the content partner. And this is, again, a way for YouTube to get higher quality content, so much so that they are allowed.
But it's not, because they're saying they're just like advancing new money, you know. They're not. I don't see how that's going to make money. I don't see how that's going to create new content.
Well, I think it'll create higher production value.
Incentive.
Yeah, it's an incentive to create higher production value. So much so that maybe some of these partners can create videos in 4K. And for those of you who don't know what 4K is, when you go to the movies and you're seeing a digitally projected film, you're seeing 2K. 4K is twice that amount. It's a very high resolution that clocks in at 4,096 by 3,072. So if you think that HD is 1080, and they are now going to allow 4,096.
That is so geeky.
Yeah, it is very geeky, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to make
it... How much can it be reflected in a computer screen?
Well, that's the thing. It's really...
You have to have the screen to show it, so...
Yeah, you have to have a 25-foot screen, first of all. That's who it would benefit.
Yeah.
But here's the thing.
I mean, I've got a plasma TV, but even if I stream my video from the computer there, it's not going to show up better than 1080.
That's exactly right. There aren't TVs that are really... capable of showing 4K yet. However, when you down-res 4K to 1080p or 1080i, of course it looks a lot better. Now, the cameras needed to record all this 4K stuff are ridiculously expensive. So this isn't something you're going to run around with a flip camera at 4K. I mean, this is really high-end pro video stuff. And not to mention the fact that to download a 4K video, you're going to need a broadband connection that is ridiculously fast. How many times have I said ridiculously during this news story?
I don't know. Let's move on.
Okay. A ridiculous number of times.
A ridiculous number of times? Okay. Well, you know, again, this is YouTube's attempt to become a programmer.
Do you guys think that's ever really going to happen?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
No. No.
I don't think so either.
They have no experience in that. They have no talent for that. They have not the zero capability or structure or management for that. They have they've zero ability to create content or be a, you know, not their game.
Well, have you taken a look at their Lean Back, which launched last week, and it's really meant for television sets and from watching your computer monitor from a distance? It's basically just, it's like MTV, but for user-generated content. It just plays one video after another on your channels.
So you don't choose what you watch next? Do they program it?
Either they program it, or you create a playlist.
But again, that's just... curating user-generated content. But I don't see them getting into original programming. I think that would be a huge mistake.
And they should know that that's not who they are and what they do. They're forgetting what their job is. Just because there's video on their thing doesn't mean they suddenly are video producers. They're going to be wasting money and time if they try and do that.
Well, now, last week we talked about Hulu, and it's launching Hulu Plus, a subscription service for $9.95 a month for a broader offering of videos. And this week... The CEO of Hulu, Jason Kilar, said that he is not averse to having a more expensive subscription that won't have any ads. I guess people were complaining that Hulu Plus still has ads, which, by the way, hello, have you seen cable? If you pay for cable television, you're paying for content, and you still get ads. So I don't see what the big deal about getting ads is.
The ads on Hulu are not a big deal. They're so short. They're a minor nuisance at best.
So it's not a big deal then?
It would be a big whoop.
Yes, that was a really poor way of getting to our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the week's top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story this week is about Roman Polanski. Is it justice served or justice denied? Roman Polanski is a free man. Switzerland rejected a U.S. request to extradite director Roman Polanski to face charges of unlawful sex with a minor from a case that occurred in the 70s. Their reason? The U.S. refused to share confidential testimony from January of 2010 that may have shown the original judge did indeed agree to the plea bargain agreement that had been worked out between the prosecution and the defense. So, Karen, I am afraid to ask, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, this is a big deal. First of all, I don't understand why the United States would not share information. I mean, who is that going to hurt? Roman Polanski?
No, probably the prosecutor. Michael, is this a big deal?
It's definitely a big deal. I mean, this is international headline news. It's just an unbelievable saga that it's not over yet, I don't think. But it also gives an ending to our friend Marina Zenovich's documentary, Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired.
That's right. Now, we have one person leaving jail. We have another entering. A Beverly Hills judge on Tuesday sentenced Lindsay Lohan to 90 days in jail for repeatedly violating the terms of her probation, ignoring the actress's tearful pleas for one more chance. In a dramatic courtroom showdown, Los Angeles County Superior Court Judge Marcia N. Revel listened as Lohan promised to do better and defended her failure to attend weekly alcohol education classes and follow earlier orders by the judge. In a side note, the next day, Sean Chapman Holly, her attorney, Lindsay Lohan's attorney, quit. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, but then she was told that she could not quit.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there you go. It's a big deal in the sense of watching it on the celebrity sort of seemingly implode and not have the ability or have the people around them to help them interact together when they're talented.
You know, I agree. It's a big deal. But to me, the bigger deal is the fact that her attorney, who comes from a boutique but fairly reputable law firm, seemed so unprepared for this. Not for the verdict. She just seemed unprepared in general. She didn't have a clear sense of what Lindsay had done as far as, you know, what court dates she'd made and what she'd missed. And she didn't seem to be entirely certain why she missed some of them. I mean, she just really seemed like this was the first time she'd ever looked at this. I thought she was a public defender. Wow. I had to look her up.
Moving on to Mel Gibson, who is not going to jail, at least that I know of, but he certainly needs to find another agent. Mad Mel, as the tabloids have dubbed him, has been let go by William Morris Endeavor after his latest publicized rant against minorities. Either Gibson went too far, even for an agent, or his antics made Gibson not worth handling anymore, especially because he wasn't bringing in a lot of business. And, of course, his agent, Ed LaMotto, passed away. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, this is a huge, huge deal. I heard that he had gotten fired. I didn't know he'd gotten fired before Ed LaMotto had passed away. That's interesting.
Yeah, he passed away on...
You know, yeah. I just think that the interesting thing here is his career over? I mean, he's wealthy enough that he can finance his own movies. What will he? And can he get actors to be in them?
Well, Gibson will be starring in The Beaver, directed by Jodie Foster, which is supposed to be distributed by Summit Entertainment. And right now, he's filming a movie titled How I Spent My Summer Vacation. I guess we're going to... Maybe we know how he spent his summer vacation. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. Genuine repercussions for, you know, your nasty behavior for your, you know, 5-10 years of repeated, you know, outlandish, offensive comments is going to come back and haunt you. But he can still do it as a director. He finances his own movie, make a Viking movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. People will go see it.
Well, Ari Emanuel, the head of William Morris Endeavor, back in 2006, when the drunk Gibson threw offensive invective around the Pacific Coast Highway, he wrote something for your stomping grounds, Michael, the Huffington Post. And at the time, he said the industry should shun Gibson. So this is, I guess, following through on what he wrote.
I wonder what agency is going to sign him.
Maybe he'll decide he doesn't need an agent. You know, at his age, he doesn't need it. At his stage, he doesn't need an agent. He can, like, David Lynch just has a lawyer. He doesn't need a manager,
just an attorney.
And all that crap. No, Gibson doesn't need one. Get a good lawyer, you're done.
Prince says the internet is dead. The artist who once pioneered reaching out directly to fans via the web and made oodles of music ready for purchase online now says that the internet is, quote, completely over, end quote, as far as artistry is concerned, just like MTV is passé when it comes to new music. The proof is in the pudding. He's been releasing singles to radio. Remember what that is, Michael? Radio? The thing? Yeah.
Singles?
Yeah. And his new album, 2010, isn't available at iTunes or even Amazon, and his website is completely kaput. So, Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, this is a pretty big deal for the guy. I know who runs his website, so it's a huge deal for him. But ultimately, I think it's a big whoop. Does anybody really think that Prince knows what he's talking about?
Michael?
I think it's a big whoop in the larger scheme of things. But Prince was pretty sad about the internet early on. As far as its hipness factor, he may have a certain point. Well, if you've got a big enough name, he's distributing albums through newspapers and other stuff. And it's interesting that he would say it. I think it's interesting.
Well, I think it's a big deal because by saying the internet is dead, Prince has actually gotten every music website on the planet and us to talk about his new album.
Oh, you're right. That's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea he had an album coming out.
I didn't either.
First, Netflix took on DVD rental stores like Blockbuster and One. Now Netflix is taking on pay cable channels like HBO. A new deal means Netflix will get to stream movies online and keep them from going to pay cable channels like HBO and Showtime. The $100 million deal with Relativity involves 11 to 30 movies a year and could be the first in a wave for Netflix to choke off the supply to pay channels. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal as far as them sucking up the movie rights, taking away from paid cable channels like HBO. That was unthinkable 10 or 20 years ago. It's amazing.
Karen?
I agree. It's a big deal. Same reason.
There will never be another James Bond movie. Okay, maybe there will. In a silly bit of reporting news, that pre-production on the next James Bond had finally and truly come to a halt, and that there was no start date remotely in view somehow got reported, by us by the way, as being the news that a new James Bond movie was dead forever. Sam Mendes and Daniel Craig begged to differ, so we know that someday, of course, a new Bond movie will hit theaters. In fact, Christopher Nolan said he might like to direct one. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal in the sense that you still need real media outlets to tell you real news from fake BS like this. As soon as I saw that headline that said, there's never going to be another Bond film, I'm like, oh, for the love of God, that is so ridiculously idiotic.
Yeah, and we certainly never said that. We said that it was on hold for...
indefinitely.
Because MGM is yeah, you know, hurting for money.
On hold indefinitely was never going to happen. That was reported all over the internet. They're never going to make another Bond film. That's what they said. That's what it said. It's all completely dead. It's ridiculous.
Karen, so is it a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big whoop.
The Little Mermaid is going live action. The story that began as a fairy tale and then became a Disney animated film and then a live action stage musical on Broadway is now headed back to the movies. Director Joe Wright of Atonement is working on what is being called, quote, a more darkly beautiful version of the story for Disney. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. Big whoop, I mean. God, big whoop.
Big whoop. So you think that it's not important? And Michael, what do you think?
I think it's a big deal. I hear Disney is also working on turning Pirates of the Caribbean into a theme park ride, and I can't wait to see it.
Do we break the news? I think, Michael...
They'll just keep going back and forth from now until the end of time.
Yeah, okay, well...
I hear they're doing a movie about it. It's a Small World.
Wait a second. If they did,
yeah,
oh God! Well, then that must be a horror film.
Okay, moving on. Maybe he should have just bought the CD for $18. In a court case involving a man who illegally posted 30 tracks on Kazaa and shared them with the world, the jury imposed a fine of $675,000, which was reduced by the judge to "quote unquote" just $67,500. Or $2,250 per track. Wow, I guess, you know, iTunes would love to have that kind of pricing. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big deal, sorry.
What, you mean?
Big whoop! Big yeah, whoop, sorry.
Well, actually, the real story here is that a jury ruled that the RIAA should get $675,000, and the judge said it was unconstitutionally excessive and then lowered it or gutted it to $67,500. So basically said no, 10%.
I wouldn't say that's gutted. A $67,000 fine for 30 tracks of music. That's a massively big fine for anybody who's just like a Joe Blow putting stuff online as opposed to a pirate. That's a huge fine.
Well, I know somebody who can help him pay it. James Cameron. He's got the money. News reports say Cameron's final haul from Avatar will be around $350 million. No director has ever made so much money from one movie. A newly expanded edition of Avatar comes out in August with a super deluxe DVD down the road, and a 3D Titanic comes out in 2012 to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the ship sinking. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
That a 3D version of Titanic is coming out?
No, that the guy made so much money.
Big whoop! Why is this not a surprise. Big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal. Wow, I mean, yeah, that's an unbelievable amount of money off one film, but, you know, the more you gamble, the more you win.
That's true. Our final story is about Ed Norton. You do not want to make him angry. You wouldn't like him when he's angry. But apparently, the people behind the Avengers aren't scared of that. Not only have they dumped him from playing the Hulk in the upcoming movie, The Avengers, they dissed him in a press release by specifically saying it wasn't a financial decision, but a creative one. Quote, "Our decision is definitely not one based on monetary factors, but instead rooted in the need for an actor who embodies the creativity and collaborative spirit of our other talented cast members," said Marvel Studios President of Production, Kevin Feige. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. There was a thing earlier with Lindsay Lohan where the studio dumped her and then said, yeah, she's useless overseas. Well, I mean, why do they feel the need to publicly mock an actor that they've worked with in the past and might want to work with in the future is beyond me. It just seems unprofessional.
Karen?
My best guess is that he is so difficult to work with that he comes in the life is too short category. No one's going to want to work with him again anyway. That is probably what they mean when they say they want to hire an actor who embodies the
creative... Absolutely. That's what they mean. Yeah. But why say that to the world?
Because they are that pissed off. This is a huge deal. It's a huge deal that if an actor gets to that point where a studio doesn't care anymore what people think about them,
yeah.
And it's also a pretty big deal for his career because it's not like he's got a huge one.
Life is too short, and this podcast might be too long if we don't move on to Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. Last week, in the middle of the week, Deadline Hollywood, Nikki Fink's blog, ran a story about a balance sheet that was made public on Warner Brothers' film Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. And it said that the film made somewhere in the neighborhood of $938 million, but somehow was in the red for $130 million. Now, we had several people write in to ask us how this could possibly be, including James Stanley Smith of Philadelphia, who said he knows this story isn't new, but was wondering how this could possibly be the case. How is it that Harry Potter could be quote-unquote unprofitable? We actually have probably the best person in the world to tell us how that is the case. His name is Edward J. Epstein. He is the author of two books, The Hollywood Economist, The Hidden Financial Reality Behind the Movies, as well as The Big Picture, Money and Power in Hollywood. And these books are, in my opinion, textbooks for Hollywood accounting and how deals are put together in Hollywood. Edward, thank you for joining us.
Well, I'm very glad you asked me to be there.
Tell us exactly, how does a movie like Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which reportedly cost $150 million to make and grossed $938 million worldwide, end up being a money loser?
It's not a money loser. It's simply a misunderstanding of what a distribution report is. We're talking about a distribution report. It's a piece of paper. Harry Potter will make hundreds of millions of dollars for Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers financed the movie. It will take in probably $300 million just as its distribution fee. It's already taken in $221 million, and much more is coming from DVDs and television. So it will make a good deal of money. Here is the confusion, okay? But let me say three things that may clarify it. First of all, everyone gets paid in Hollywood. Maybe not on independent movies, but on Hollywood movies. There are hundreds of people that work on them, including stars and lawyers and sound men and technicians. They all get paid. No one gets cheated. Secondly, the agreements, these are all freelance people. everyone on a movie. Even Steven Spielberg is a freelance person. They don't work for the studio. So they sign contracts negotiated by their agents, their lawyers, and their business managers with the students, with the studios. And those contracts specify when they will be paid, how they will be paid, and what relation it will have to the money flowing in from the movie. The distribution statement that we're talking about is an accounting which all these contracts are pegged to. So it tells you when you're eligible to get money that's owed to you as part of your contingency payment. Now, what happens is Hollywood is a fee-driven business. Movies are a fee-driven business. People get fees, and these fees are divided two ways. They get a fixed fee. Arnold Schwarzenegger might get a fixed fee of $29.8 million as his fixed compensation. That they get in advance, or they get when as the movie's shooting, depending on the arrangement. The second is the contingency fee, which depends on the performance of the movie. Now, in this case, Warner Brothers owns the movie. Warner Brothers is administering the accounting for it and clearing the sums of money. So this distribution sheet, the only person that could possibly be cheated is Warner Brothers, because it's basically, it has a 30% distribution fee. So every dollar that comes in, they take 30 cents out of it. And that money shows up on a sheet as a loss. I mean, it's coming out of the movie, that 30%, and it's going to Warner Brothers. Why Warner Brothers gets this movie, this money, which has been agreed upon in advance by everyone concerned, is it's taking all the risks, it's financing the movie, it's doing the marketing campaign, and that's its fee for doing it, just like it's the fee of the movie stars for performing in it. Okay, so that's the distribution fee continually adds up. Also, stars in the movie, okay, who get what are called gross points, they get a percentage of the gross. As they get money, and they might get money from the first dollar that comes in, as they get money, it is added to the budget of the movie. So if we look at this particular movie, we see that the budget, which, as you say, cost approximately $160 million to make, is listed under investment as $315 million. The difference being that what's being added into the movie is the fees being paid to various stars according to their contracts who are getting the money. Then it adds, including the author, the writer of the book, all the people who get paid. As they get paid, it gets added onto the budget of the movie. Now, who this makes a difference for is what's called the net players. Those are people who don't have gross points. They get a percentage of the net. And that means that each time a gross player takes a dollar out, it pushes them further away from ever getting paid. But who are the net players? They tend to be the weaker actors, writers, sometimes even producers, who don't have the power when they sit down for the contract to become gross players. And they do get fixed compensation, with exception of possibly the producers.
And so when we're talking about these losses, it's really not a loss to Warner Brothers, because these films are done under companies. Isn't that correct? They create a company
right.
Just for the production, which is...
Exactly. This is just an accounting company, so that they can account, you know, they're not cheating the government. There is no cheating going on, actually. There might be, by the way. I mean, you would have to get into what the negative actually costs and how much is really being added on. Of course, there could be cheating. But the fact that a film, it's fascinating, and it's a great story, because what the story is that it's very expensive, not only making a film, but advertising a film. Look at some of the logistic expenses that you wouldn't ever think of. Dubbing, $5.6 million. Taxes, those are foreign taxes, $8 million. Trade Association, that's the MPA you're paying, which they own, they're paying $4.5 million. Freight and shipping, $3.7 million. Then they have to pay the guilds and the unions a residual, mainly on television, but that's $10 million. So what these distribution reports, I'm glad that Mickey Fing published hers. I published three or four in my book. In fact, one is the appendix to The Hollywood Economist. But they tell such an interesting story about where the money goes. A movie is a very expensive enterprise, And there are literally maybe 30 or 40,000 pages of contracts which govern how this money that comes in is paid back to the people that are involved.
I think I've known since I was a little kid reading Variety that net points are a joke. If you don't have gross points, you're not going to ever see any money. So my question is, why do they bother? Why don't they just give people a gold star? Everybody, most people know if they're given net points that it's just sort of a pat on the back and a friendly little gesture towards them and that they're not going to see any money. Why did the studios bother, and why did the lawyers bother asking for it, and why did they bother setting up a separate little set of accounting to show why they're never going to get any money? Why do it at all?
Well, you're absolutely right. And once I was in a position myself when I was selling a book to Hollywood where I wanted to know why I had to Xerox this entire 300-page contract when I wasn't going to see a penny, okay? But to answer your question, and I think it's a key question, it's very simple. Let's say an actor has a quote, which is the price he normally gets paid or wants to get paid of $10 million. And they say, look, we'll pay you $10 million. Most we can afford to pay you or will pay you is $2 million. Now, the agent comes back and tells him that. And, of course, he's furious. And then the agent says, but, look, we'll do a back-end deal and we'll get so many net points. Well, you're right. He knows he's not going to get back his money on those back-end points. But he actually can tell people, well, I actually have a lot of points in the movie. It's a way of, it exists only in Hollywood. It should exist in the book publishing business too, by the way. It's a way of giving people sort of little gold stars, and they're called net points. And, you know, when the system started, which was, you know, with Jimmy Stewart back in the 1950s, and net meant something. Now, as David Mamet said famously, there is no net. And that therefore these long contracts that define the net are defining something that is very unlikely to ever happen. And yet it seems to make people feel better that they have points, as they call them, in a movie. But you're right.
Now, this is Hollywood movies we're talking about. It is a little bit different with an independent film, isn't it? If you're involved in a $3 million movie and you are given net points, say on something like Paranormal Activities, a movie with a tiny budget, it's reasonable for you, if this movie somehow explodes and makes $80, $90 million, to say, well, now, I don't care how much rejiggering you do on the books. There's no way I don't deserve to get some points here and some money.
Well, you're, again, absolutely right. The world of difference between independent Hollywood movies. But, you know, independent movies are distributed by Hollywood distributors. Paramount distributed Paranormal Activities. And they still take their distribution fee. Now, if someone else finances the film, that distribution fee, rather than 30%, might be 20%, 17%, or even lower. And if the percentage of the distribution fee is lower, okay, and for someone like Steven Spielberg, he could negotiate a 10%, or Marvel Comics could negotiate a 10% distribution fee. If you could get it that low, then it is possible that there'll be some net proceeds to divide. The studios fight to the death over this percentage. It actually costs something to distribute a film, maybe 8% or 9%. But it's very hard, unless you're a George Lucas or Steven Spielberg, to get them to cut their distribution fee, with one exception. If you put up all the financing, then you could get a 17.5% or 15% distribution fee, because they're not risking their financing. The studios actually perform something. They risk money in order to get the movie into the theaters.
Well, yes, and then when they start getting that money back, one of the fees here that everybody pointed to as being maybe a little high, or it was questioned as to how it could be so high, was the interest. There's close to $60 million worth of interest mm-hmm. being paid out on Harry Potter
right.
Order of the Phoenix. Where does that interest come from? Obviously, it comes from loaning money to the company making the film.
Well, actually, it's a fictional number, okay, as is overhead. In other words, they have so much money flowing in from older movies, they don't have to actually go to the bank and borrow the money. But money is valuable. They could, because otherwise they can invest the money in normal times, not these times, but you used to be able to invest the money in T-bills or something. So the interest is almost a fictional number, and it's there basically, that just builds up, because I guess in the studio's accounting, if a film takes 3 or 4 years to get the money, they feel that they should be paid something for the 3 or 4 years they're waiting to get the money back.
Well, now let's talk about that fictional number here, and I guess I'm going to ask the question more in a way that pertains to television shows, because last week, Walt Disney Company lost a $270 million jury verdict over Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and the production company Celador International was seeking, I guess, $269.4 million in damages. They are the company originally that brought the show from the UK to the US and sold it to Disney. And what Celador was claiming was that the Disney-owned ABC and Buena Vista Television violated a complex deal to produce and distribute Millionaire in North America by brokering sweetheart deals among themselves that cheated Celador out of its share of millions of dollars. The same was true of David Duchovny when he sued 20th Century Fox over the X-Files. And the same is true, another verdict that came down last week, Nash Bridges' Don Johnson won $23 million for the same type of accounting quirks is what I would call them. Yeah, yes.
The key word in what you say is complex deals. These are very, very complex deals. And obviously, in the cases you're mentioned, there is a dispute over whether, one, they carried out the terms of the contract, and secondly, whether the terms were fraudulent. A sweetheart deal selling it to one of their subsidiaries would, of course, be fraudulent. You know, and for that reason, there's a whole industry of forensic accountants who go around trying to make sure, because as I say, it's a very complex business. And in the cases that you're referring to, there's obviously a dispute. I don't know the facts of those cases. I'd be very interested in finding them out, but very little has been published so far, but I think they could be fascinating. Part of the huge deception of Hollywood, and I'm not talking about the studios or that part of it, I'm talking about everyone in the Hollywood community wants to represent they're doing better than they're actually doing. That this is a tough business, and that it's not a business where if you turn down one movie part, there's another movie part waiting for you. Even if you're a star, you might not work for another year. So the lubricant that keeps this whole system running are these meaningless net points.
We've never done this before, but we would like to offer you 3 net points on the profitability of this particular podcast as a thank you gift for coming onto the show for us.
Right, you see, this whole concept could be expanded, but that's more or less how it works. And everyone is happy, and it gives them some hope, and then it gives them something to gripe about.
Well, Edward J. Epstein, thank you very much for taking the time to explain what is a fascinating subject to me. Your books, The Hollywood Economist and The Big Picture, I have them on my bookshelves. You can have them on yours by going to Amazon.com and picking them up. We will place links to them in the show notes. And your website is edwardjepstein.com. We will also place a link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this conversation with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, that was very nice of Mr. Epstein to join us and talk to us about what I think a lot of people are maybe mistaken about or confused about, or they don't completely understand, and I count myself among them.
You know, I was really surprised that he was almost pro-studio, just judging from some of the things that he's written that I read. I thought that he would be more on the side of, you know, thinking, not calling the studios crooks per se, but I just didn't expect him to be quite so pro-studio.
Well, I don't know that he's pro-studio so much as he's saying, look, read the contract, and the contract has been signed, and the contract was signed with all of these, with the knowledge that this would occur.
Yeah.
Which is very different from saying that they can just do whatever they want with the accounting. He's just saying, look, the fact is that $800 million doesn't mean on a technical level it's going to be profitable for the people who have gotten that point.
This has always been a topic that's fascinating.
And another topic that's fascinating is your emails. We'd really like to receive them. You can send them to us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-567-SAND is the phone number. Again, that's 888-567-7263. You can leave us a voicemail. You can find all of this information, including all of our social networking accounts like YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn. You can find it all on showbizsandbox.com, which is where you will find the show notes for this episode, which have links to all of the stories we've talked about. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found at on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com, or on Twitter. At Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen is on Twitter. Her username is at Karen_Woodward. I don't have a personal website, but you can find some of my writing at celluloidjunkie.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.